When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, my name is David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We've reached the penultimate episode in our series with the writer and philosopher Lea Ippe about the history of freedom. And today, we're talking about existentialism and psychoanalysis, Sartre and Freud. Is personal bad faith the true enemy of human freedom? And to be really free, do we also all need to be on the couch? This episode of Past, Present, Future is sponsored by Faber Books. Faber, home to writers from T.S. Eliot and Sylvia Plath to Kazuo Ishiguro and Sally Rooney, has been publishing independently for nearly a century across poetry and fiction, but also politics, philosophy, biography, history, drama, and film. Especially for PPF listeners, Faber have collected together a selection of books by some of the great writers and thinkers of the 20th and 21st centuries. Just go to faber.co.uk/PPF, and there you'll find titles including James Shapiro on Shakespeare, Tanya Branigan on the Cultural Revolution, Gary Young on American Crises, Catherine Rundell on John Donne, Milan Kundera on Central Europe, and Matthew Hollis on T.S. Eliot. Exclusively for listeners to PPF, Faber are offering 20% off all titles. Simply head to faber.co.uk/PPF and use the code PODCAST in the checkout. And while you're there, you might also become a Faber member. It's free to join, and Faber members get access to beautiful member editions, a live and online events program, articles, book discounts, and more. Today we're going to talk about existentialism and maybe a bit about psychoanalysis as well. Existentialism is the kind that we're going to be talking about, a 20th century philosophy. It has its roots in the 19th century, but I'm thinking here of people like Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir. It's not easy. So full disclosure, I had a go at reading Being and Nothingness, and I'm not sure I'm any better qualified to talk about it, having tried to read it, than if I hadn't read it. So please, you know, anyone listening, forgive me if I don't seem like I'm completely on top of it. On the other hand, some of the core ideas are very accessible. It's a weird combination of a philosophy that is incredibly intricate and intellectually demanding, and yet some of the ideas just leap out, and people often latch onto them without bothering with the underlying philosophy. Maybe one way to start with this is actually to compare existentialism to a philosophy that we discussed a few episodes ago, which is Stoicism, because they are sometimes compared, and indeed they're sometimes conflated, I think, partly because Stoicism is also a complicated philosophy that has one or two things that you can just pull out and use as a guide to life. I'm thinking in particular of someone like Viktor Frankl, Austrian psychiatrist, but also Holocaust survivor. He wrote his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, about his experiences, among other places, in Auschwitz. And from that, people take often the core idea that it is possible to be free, and indeed even to find not just meaning, but a form of happiness and fulfillment somewhere as extreme and awful as Auschwitz. And that can sound a bit like Stoicism and what we talked about earlier, which is the idea, well, okay, you're a slave, but you know, that's your situation, but you are a free human being in the sense that you can decide what you feel about, what you think about, how you understand your situation. And existentialism can often seem like it is offering the same kind of solace. So I don't think it is. But I did find myself wondering, because you talked about your grandmother as a sort of model of a certain kind of stoic attitude to her own life. Did she give off to you existential or existentialist vibes as well? Did you get a sense from her that you could also describe her attitude as an existentialist one?
Mm. No. And I think, I tell you why, but I also have to start with a full disclosure, because the full disclosure will influence what I'm going to say and how it might sound. I did actually read a lot of Heidegger, in part because of my research on Kant. And so a lot of my knowledge of existentialism comes from the engagement with German idealism tradition, and to some extent also criticisms of German idealist tradition. But that means that I have a slightly biased/negative view, because I did a lot of research on these debates around Kant's metaphysics and its relationship to time and first phenomenology, but also existentialism, which came out in some ways from 20th century phenomenology, begins really as an engagement with these questions of metaphysics. And indeed, Heidegger's Being and Time is all about metaphysics and what metaphysics has done to our knowledge and our philosophy and our way of engaging with the world. And I came out of it quite critical. And this is how it's connected to my grandmother. Not that my grandmother ever knew anything about existentialism. Sometimes it goes the other way around. You know, we get told certain things as children, which maybe we'll go back to some things that we might say later about relationship between existentialism and psychoanalysis. But we get told certain things in children, and then somehow impacts how you then engage with the world and how you think about certain philosophies. So my grandmother was more of a Stoic than an existentialist, because somehow she thought of responsibility more in a kind of Stoic way than in an existentialist way. And I think although both of them obviously are philosophies that emerge from crisis and from a crisis of the world, and where there is this figure who tries to make sense of crisis and somehow needs to find inner strength, there is a different relationship to values, as I see it, and in particular to the kind of value of the whole. It seems to me that Stoicism is still trying to think about value as an overarching structure in which the individual then has to try to find meaning and make sense of the world. And that value has often to do with the way in which people relate to each other. As I see it in existentialism, or as I understand it in existentialism, yes, there is still the question of how the individual engages with the world, but more as an individual rather than as a part of a larger structure, which also itself has meaning. The way I see that might be the kind of key difference. As I say, they're both philosophies of crisis. They both emphasize responsibility. They both focus on this idea of inner freedom and on this kind of recognition of responsibility in connection to inner freedom. But there may be something to do with the relationship between the kind of individual and the structure of the universe that is very, very different in existentialism and Stoicism.
Yeah, and I think in a way the fundamental difference is that if you're a Stoic, you believe there is an order out there, and Stoicism is the rational response to the order of the universe, the knowable order of the universe. And one consequence of that is that if you are a Stoic philosopher, you can guide people in how to live. The point of Stoicism is that it is a guide in how to live. But existentialism is not a guide in how to live, because you are much more on your own than that, in a sense. It enables you to believe that it is possible for you as an individual to find your own value in a universe that doesn't have objective values out there that can be discovered or revealed by the use of reason or logic. I mean, Stoicism has a logic behind it. This is not accessible for an existentialist, because it is bleak. You know, there is no value there, and you've got to create your own. So it's a more radical philosophy in that sense. And I suppose in that sense also, therefore, it's more radical than the thing that your grandmother was embracing. It's also less consoling. I mean, Stoicism, weirdly, is quite a consoling. I mean, I think you said it before, it's a consoling philosophy. You may be a slave, but take heart. Maybe not the Viktor Frankl version, but the Jean-Paul Sartre version is not consoling. I mean, whatever else you might think about it, it warns you that it is utterly bleak out there. And it's going to take an awful lot of courage to find meaning in a world that is not going to give you any.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's why I've sort of become increasingly suspicious of it as I became exposed to it. And I think it's...
Do you think it's dangerous?
No, I don't think it's dangerous. I just think that there is only so much you can do with this radically pessimistic approach to the world. And so, although I share the diagnosis and I share the critique of traditional authorities and conventions and consolidated values and the need to engage with all of that in a very, very critical way, I think then there has to be a point where the criticism becomes more constructive than existentialism really allows you afford, in part because it has this very pessimistic view of human nature and of other people. And so that's where I feel the limits begin to emerge when you start trying to think about it. Okay, but how do you get out of this? And in fact, this is where I started with this discussion around Kantian philosophy, Heidegger's engagement with Kantian philosophy. There is at some point this famous debate that happens between Heidegger and Cassirer in Davos, you know, the site of the Swiss, well, the, you know, Davos.
Yeah, the home of Davos man.
The site of where the Davos Forum happens, but it's also, as you know, the site of where the Magic Mountain was played. And which is in its way also a kind of existentialist novel, in part also informed by these debates. But there's this famous debate in Davos between Heidegger and Cassirer, a neo-Kantian philosopher of the beginning of the 20th century. And it's a debate all about this, in a way, the concept of meaning and what meaning and metaphysics and Kant's engagement with traditional metaphysics. And there is a point where when I was reading this debate, I felt, okay, this is where I'm jumping philosophically. Am I going with Heidegger or am I going with Cassirer? And Cassirer, at some point, he puts this question to Heidegger. He says, look, all your philosophy, all your discussion around metaphysics and our human condition and so on, it's all about where we're coming from. It's about the origin. And okay, once you've given us this very pessimistic account of the origin and of the human condition, what are you going to do with it? And I'm thinking about where we're going, and you're stuck in where we were. And I felt that really captured why, in the end, I became so hostile to Heideggerianism and to all sort of philosophical currents that were in some ways informed by that. Because I felt, yeah, I'm interested in where this is all going. And so there is only so much that you can do with just digging on, okay, but, you know, we're flawed and we're thrown with this very, very pessimistic account of human nature.
I'm guessing, therefore, for that reason, you're also going to be suspicious of psychoanalysis, but let's come on to that a bit later. I don't want to second guess.
No, actually, no, I'm much less suspicious of, in particular, Freud and sort of Freudian analysis, because I see psychoanalysis in many ways also as social analysis and as giving a really important contribution to social analysis. And I think it's more constructive in its contribution, and its criticism is also much more constructive in its contribution to the diagnosis of the ills of contemporary society than some, I mean, not all existentialists are destructive. So maybe the Heidegger versions I'm more skeptical of, and perhaps there is something in Sartre and others that is a little bit different, but yeah.
Okay, we'll come on to psychoanalysis because I'm intrigued now to know how it's more constructive. But if we talk about, so we won't do Heidegger, let's do the Sartre version, not because we're going to get into the details, but to pull out, so I'm going to do the thing that I slightly criticize people for doing, which is to pull out a few ideas. But they do seem to speak to some basic instinctive understandings of the challenge of freedom, what it means to be free, particularly in the modern world, in a world in which we may be beyond a certain kind of hierarchy of values that we can rely on. So one of them is the idea of bad faith, which I think, again, it's complicated, but it speaks to people. And it's based on a famous Sartrean idea, which is that existence precedes essence. One version of bad faith is to believe that essence determines existence. That is, we are all in this world and come into this world as essential creatures of one kind or another. Not our identity, but our actual essence, what we are, how we would define ourselves, is given. And an existentialist would say it's not given. The existence comes first, and the essence is in some sense acquired or adopted or even chosen, though that's complicated because it's not clear you can actually choose your essence because there are facts in the world that are beyond human choice. But one version of bad faith is to say to other human beings, I can't do this, I can't do that because of who I am. You know, I am who I am. I don't really have a choice here. I am this kind of person. I'm that kind of person. I'm afraid of this. That's me. That's my essence. And the existentialist would say, it's not true. And one of the ways that this is sometimes framed is to take a common human response to a crisis, which is to say, I can't bear it. And an existentialist might say, that's false. Actually, that's bad faith to say, I can't bear it. You should say, I won't bear it because you've chosen not to bear it. That's a challenging idea. But there is another version of bad faith, which is almost the inversion of that, which is people going around thinking that they have choice about things they really don't have a choice about. You know, you can go too far with that idea and think that you can create your own identity. You can pick your identity in the world. You can say, I don't like being this person. I'm going to be that person. I don't want to be the person I came into the world as. I don't want these parents. Well, you've got no choice about that. They are your parents. You can't deny that. So you've got these two versions of bad faith. And there is something quite powerful about that idea. I think we all recognize that we are surrounded by it. And indeed, I think we all recognize that we all do it a lot. I mean, we just do it a lot. Human beings do often find themselves saying, I can't bear it. You know, it's not me. I can't do that. And the existentialist would say, have the courage to know that you have a real choice here. Does that not speak to you? That's not necessarily pessimistic. There's something quite powerful about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's it, exactly, that's sort of going back, because now we've gone from the Heidegger to the Sartrean version, in a way, of existentialism. Those are the bits of existentialism that I like, and they do resonate. And they resonate because, in a way, they're showing you that you always, that it, in fact, it's part of being free that you have these choices. And often they are moral choices. And sometimes we need to know how these moral choices, what is the background against which they are formed, which is where the genealogical story becomes really important, because not all backgrounds make it easier or harder for you. But at the bottom, there is something about the fact that you are a being that makes choices. Now, what I'm more skeptical about is this idea that existence comes before essence, because in a way, and this was also part of the Heideggerian criticism of Sartre, he was saying to Sartre, look, you said existence precedes essence, but actually you've just replaced one kind of metaphysics with another kind of metaphysics, because you've made an equally strong statement about the types of beings that we are. And so the radical Heideggerian version, you would say, and that's where actually Heidegger ends up towards the end of his life, you can't say any of these things. And indeed, philosophy can't really give you any answers of that kind. And so you have to look elsewhere, to literature or art or some other types of expression. So this is where I see, in a way, there is a tension in existentialism. And going back to the comparison with the Stoics, that's also where the difference with the Stoics are. The Stoics would say essence precedes existence. And so there is an order there of, there is a right way of thinking about the world that, in which our choices individually would fit. And I think I agree with that. I think there is a way of thinking about the world that is, there is a kind of essence of morality there. How you cash that out and how you think about the relationship between psychological, social, moral influences and impulses and the complexity of the human, psychological complexity, normative complexity. That's all to be discussed. But the bottom line, I think, if you're going to say, look, you do have a choice, that choice has got to have something to do with the kind of beings that we are, namely beings that have choices. And so that is an argument about essence, I think, at the end.
But to say that we're beings that have choices, that could be reduced to something that is, again, constraining. I mean, there is a version of existentialism where it kind of says to people, you know, you have to fit this mold. It's not enough to go about in the world as though you were a being that doesn't have a choice, because that's not who you are. You actually are this other kind of thing. And as you said, actually, I think people's circumstances do really vary. It's a bit like the criticism I made of Stoicism, which seems to me Stoicism is a good philosophy if you're lucky enough to be in circumstances where you can adopt it. There are many circumstances which you can't. There are facts about the world, not just that there is a moral order to the world, but there are basic facts about the world which limit the way in which human beings can experience things, the ways in which human thinking can adapt. We are constrained by our circumstances. And part of the challenge of existentialism, as I see it, is that it's both very appealing, but also it's really hard. I mean, it's very difficult to tread this fine line between, as you suggest, you could just replicate the thing that you're meant to be attacking and saying, right, I'm replacing this essence with the new essence is to be this kind of Sartrean human being. And you know, that's not going to work. But it also can't be as radically liberating as someone saying, we all just create it for ourselves, that we're all able to invent or conjure up an essence for ourselves because existence precedes essence. It can't be either of those two things. And then the thing that makes it even harder, and this I think is, you know, Sartre would recognize this is the biggest challenge of all, you are doing it in a social setting. You're not doing it up the magic mountain or in the cave or anywhere else. You're doing it among other people. And as he said, other people are hell. And part of what that means is that they're doing it too. You know, you're creating freedom for yourself under conditions in which you are also an object of their freedom. their radical freedom reduces you to an object just in the way that your radical freedom might reduce them to an object. And this is played out in basic human relationships. It's played out in love. It's played out in marriage. You know, in a human relationship, that this version of freedom means you can leave and it means they can leave. And you have to, you know, find out, how do you live with that?
Yeah, right. Which is why Sartre and Beauvoir had such difficult and troublesome relationship, right? Because they tried to live.
Well, I think there were other reasons.
They tried to live by those principles, and it was hard. But I think
particularly, I have to say, it was hard for her.
That's right. It was, well, maybe that may exactly have to do with the fact that, you know, your essence in some ways does have a role to play in how you then think about your existence. And so maybe in part because there are all these factors that influence how we think. And so maybe he was more liberated than her also for a structural reason, which I think she was probably aware of. And it's interesting that even though she was aware of it, she still struggled, right? Because she was still determined by those choices that society had made for her and that therefore conditioned how she thought about certain things. So I think that's all to show that actually in their own relationship, in their own personal lives, where they tried to live by those commitments, they struggled, and the difficulty illustrates, I think, what you were trying to say. But I think I also think that there's another aspect of this which is important and maybe missing in the existentialist story, which is that, yes, people are bad, but they're not bad at all times for the same reasons. And you need a kind of social analysis and a political analysis to explain what kind of evils emerge at what times and disappear at other times. And so you need a kind of critique of a more historical critique of values, which I think maybe the existentialists were reluctant to offer because they were so focused on individuals rather than larger social units. And so then, you know, something like what I think of as a traditional Hegelian understanding of history or freedom that focuses a little bit more on collectives, they were so reluctant. And so I always think they never moved past the first two figures of the phenomenology. You know, they got to reason, but they're really reluctant to make the transition from reason to spirit. And so that's why then their philosophies have less tools to navigate the complexity of the world, both natural and social, in a way in which maybe other types of thought are, I think, more productive when you're trying to think about that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you think when you look at 21st century social settings, and it is unquestionably a part of the world in which we live, that there is a lot of thinking about and experimenting with the idea that identity may be malleable and we can possibly choose it. And there's a lot of sort of pushing back against the identities that we might come into this world with. And there is, I think, unquestionably a growing frustration with some of the social construction of identities that are then taken to shape your ability to express ideas like, I can't do this, I can't do that. Is it possible in a 21st century setting to distinguish between the ones that are and should be malleable and the ones that we ought to treat more like facts? So if you're Sartre, you know, this is part of the challenge of being human, to try and distinguish between, and it, you know, it sounds almost like a trite greetings card message. You know, there is that version of it. Give me the courage, the strength, the wisdom to know what I can and can't change. It is a version of that, right? It's a version of, you've got to be able to distinguish between where your ability to choose can meaningfully be exercised, and that form of bad faith, which is to think that you're exercising meaningful choice and you're not. Do you think in a 21st century setting, we have the tools, we have the ability to distinguish between the identities, the essences that are within our power to choose and the ones that aren't? I'm not sure I do think that we have that ability, actually.
I mean, I think we always have to have that ability because it's part of understanding the human as capable of making choices that are driven by principles that you have to always think about that capacity as being there. So I don't have a problem with that. For me, the question is more that there are types of thought that enable you or constrain you in exercising those choices. And so just because you say, just when you say, look, you always have the choice, it doesn't mean that the choice is easily made by anyone in any context. For whatever reason, there are also social and political constraints on choice. And that's why sometimes, and this is maybe where, again, when I was thinking about the more promising aspects of existentialist philosophy, I think Sartre and de Beauvoir understood that there is also an important collective element in articulating the ability to make those choices. Or if you're engaged as part of a collective that is trying to change certain things, that makes it easier because it motivates you morally in a way that you might not be as morally motivated. Whereas I think where we are now, what I think is difficult about the times in which we live is that it's very undialectical. You know, we either think of the humans as having choices, which is a lot of the neoliberal or capitalist ideology about, you know, you can do whatever, you can be what you want, empowerment, self-help, all this theories of, you know, it's all you need to do is to want something really hard and then you can do it. It's fine. It's in your power, which is very centered on the individual and doesn't really consider social constraints on the one hand. And on the other hand, the idea of complete paralysis and this notion that you're completely a slave of the circumstances and you can never emerge beyond them because, you know, someone is always trying to obstruct you. And so there's always some social constraint on your ability to exercise your freedom. And I think what we're missing is something that goes from one to the other. So this capacity to actually be able to move from the idea that you're all constrained by social relations or by politics or different ways of understanding that. And this idea that you're actually always free and you could do whatever you like, because it turns out some people can do whatever they like more than others, as you said. And I think what the existentialists, as I say, in particular Sartre and then de Beauvoir, and maybe Camus to some extent as well, what they emphasized was also this idea that if you're part of a collective that is trying to change things, that makes it easier for the individual. And this is where his notion of committed art and, you know, engagement and this importance of being engaged in the world all came from. And I think we've maybe lost that more. Engagement now always means being engaged with your own ideas and with your own thoughts. And it's a very, very different kind of engagement from how it was understood back then.
So what you described sounds like that we are living in the age of bad faith, right? Those are the two examples of bad faith that you've just described. So one version of bad faith is the promise of liberation through self-help, through forms of fulfillment that you can acquire for yourself. It makes the world seem more malleable than it is, and it makes the human condition seem more malleable than it is. Most of the promises of self-help are false. They are offered in bad faith. And then on the other hand, that powerlessness, that's the other side of it. That sense that you can't replace the word can with the word will, or the word can't with the word won't, more to the point. Can't do this, can't do that. I'm trapped. I am trapped in my essence. I am who I am, and I am part of this thing which doesn't allow me a way out. And actually, as you described it, I thought it in existentialist terms, that was a pretty compelling account of why the problem is bad faith. That is exactly what the problem is. And the danger of certain kinds of social and epistemological arrangements, that sounds a bit pretentious, but, you know, organizing the world around a certain idea of what it is to know and to understand, of which self-help is an example. Our version of it is that we've somehow allowed ourselves to lurch from bad faith to bad faith without passing through that terrifying space in between, which is where you can do stuff. But it, you know, it is frightening, but it's almost not as frightening as that space not existing at all. Actually, I thought you just gave quite a compelling account of why the Sartrean version of it is a really powerful critique.
Yeah, as I say, and I agree up to that point. But what I don't like in the critique is that it seems to me that there is no narrative of how you go from one form of bad faith to another form of bad faith. I mean, you know, if you think about, I gave you the example of Hegel earlier because I really like the way in which he describes in the Phenomenology of Spirit, the way in which the kind of this trajectory of reason that is embedded in social and political relations, and that accounts for a lot of the different types of pathologies that you encounter as you move from one era, let's say, to another. And mean, I think there are a lot of problems with Hegel's account in the phenomenology and with Hegelian metaphysics, but there's something to this idea of progress in history and to the way in which he at least it tries to capture the movement from one stage to another, which I think no other philosophy after, except for Marxism maybe, articulates or tries to articulate in the same way. And it loses something in losing this question of progress, of how do you, not all forms of bad faith are the same. And not all societies and not all historical epochs have the same constraints. And how do you account from one constraint rather than another constraint? You need a more robust analysis of society and politics than I think the existentialists gave or had, or that even they recognized that they needed.
A problem that I have with the Sartrean and de Beauvoir versions of existentialism, and this is not, there's nothing sophisticated about this, there's nothing like as sophisticated as what you just said, and it is much more ad hominem or ad feminem. It's where they ended up politically. I find it hard to get past it, and people don't like this criticism because they think it's sort of trivializing in a way. So being a nothingness is a work of great philosophical sophistication, depth, and indeed difficulty. But Sartre also wrote plays, he wrote fiction, a lot of it is very compelling, and he was a ridiculous person, and he lived a almost self-parodic life in various periods, including politically. So he was a Stalinist, and he was a Maoist. You know, towards the end, he became a Maoist. They both became Maoists. There was a period, 1968 and afterwards, where Maoism was the fashionable left-bank philosophy. Now, I don't know whether, you know, if you're an existentialist of the kind that they were and capable of writing these works of philosophy and also these works of fiction, politics is just a kind of, you know, sideshow and a hobby and you shouldn't take it too seriously. But I have a real problem with people who wind up as Maoists, actually. I think there's something missing there. And I don't know whether there is actually deep down a connection between these two ideas of bad faith. You've got to find something in between. But what you find in between is really unformed and it's really open. And like you say, it doesn't actually have structure to it. So it allows human beings to kind of lurch around from position to position and look for solidarity and look for the collective in places where if you just opened your eyes, you can see this is really not it. You can make a list of some of the things that de Beauvoir and Sartre said about Stalin's Soviet Union and about Mao's China that do not age well. I mean, it's grotesque. Their blinkered inability to understand how hopelessly flawed those systems were for achieving collective liberation. Is it wrong of me to think maybe that does have something to do with the fact that they were existentialists?
Yeah, well, I haven't thought enough about this, the particular connections between their existentialism and their Maoism, because I don't think any philosopher is immune from embracing very bad ideas, and indeed any body of thought. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, Heidegger was a Nazi, ended up being a Nazi.
Which is also a very bad idea.
It was also a very bad idea. I mean, you know, you can go from Jesus to the Crusades, and you can go from liberalism to extermination of people outside Europe. And so there's all kinds of connections between philosophies and bad things happening in the world. Because they were so critical of their own societies, sometimes people get infatuated with the alternative just because it's an alternative. And so you end up making this mistake because, as I say, you become really critical in one dimension and somehow suspend the criticism in another dimension, in part as a result of this very strong commitment. But I don't think there's anything inherently problematic about existentialism that makes you go, you know, become Maoist. I'm sure there are a lot of other philosophers or people with alternative philosophical inclinations that ended up attracted to these ideas for other reasons. So I don't think there is a kind of straight passage there from one to the other. But as I say, in part because I haven't thought enough about this, because I tend to be very dismissive of efforts to read into someone's philosophical commitments than an account of why biographically they ended up endorsing something very problematic. I mean, a lot of people thought about the Soviet Union, maybe not in the 60s, but certainly in the 30s, 40s, there were terrible things happening in the Soviet Union in the 30s. And yet there were people who were visiting it and thinking, oh, yeah, no, there is an experiment here. There's an engagement with critiques of authority. And I remember reading recently something from Keynes after a visit to the Soviet Union, where he says something like this, you know, I don't like what is going on there, but there is something really interesting and innovative happening in the way in which this society is producing something's never been seen before and doing it without traditional adherence to religion or to authority in a way in which we understand it. And he found that was, intellectually interesting. And maybe then people became more attracted to it. And ended up, not Keynes, but others ended up more committed to that version of society than they would have otherwise done. But as I say, having said that, I don't tend to exonerate anyone. So I think there's terrible things happening in liberal societies as well at the same time, and the connection to liberalism for the same reasons. And we just tend to be a little bit more maybe willing to condone that and to be very, very hostile to Maoism and Stalinism and all that.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things I want to say. One of which is I totally agree. The people who shared that sense that at least what you can say for Leninism or Stalinism or Maoism is that this is an exciting experiment. You know, it's a remarkably broad list. It includes people like Max Weber. I mean, Weber said of Leninism, at least he's having a go, kind of thing. Weber, the prophet of political responsibility. But that's because I think all philosophers have this existentialist streak in them. They're capable of having their moment where they think, you know, enough of the bad faith in the world. Let's find something authentic. But I also, part of me does think the thing that you're most attuned to is bad faith. You can be seduced by a kind of fake authenticity, which is something different. And trying to find that ground between these two kinds of bad faith, that the liberal version, which says you can be what you want to be, which isn't true, and the defeatist version that says you're trapped in the systems that you're in, which is also not true. What you're drawn to is these hyper seemingly authentic versions, because it's not bad faith. The reason it's not bad faith is I actually think it's worse than bad faith. It's just a lie, which is something.
But there are authentic versions of everything that can be presented to you. There is an authentic version of a liberal capitalist society that we've never seen before, a kind of libertarian ideal whereby you might find some place in the world that offers you that authenticity and be willing to just accept that, or indeed do things politically, commit to doing certain things, which is indeed what I think a lot of liberals in the 19th century were doing, where they thought, okay, it's fine to go out there and just tell these people what they need to do to create functioning commercial societies, and if we just have to kill a few people, it'll be fine. I mean, that's a kind of authenticity that they're in search of, the authenticity of this ideal that produces welfare for everyone. And if only they just see it. And that's an authenticity that I think is, again, in the future, but in the name of which you're then prepared to accept or to legitimize a lot of bad things happening in the present. And we know a lot of philosophers of a liberal kind that fall in the same trap than many of people like Sartre and de Beauvoir fell for other types of thought. So what I'm saying is I don't really see how any one of them is more prone to this problem than any other. I think it's just every body of thought is likely to, when it meets the world, the real world, if it's got a kind of dogmatic commitment to itself, to then end up in tragedies.
Yeah, and I think it's a version of a more common instance of this problem, which isn't just bad faith. It's the search for something that is emancipation from hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is one of the things that is a ubiquitous feature of all political life. And there's always a temptation to try and find the ground between the different hypocrisies. You know, there are hypocrisies everywhere, and you're trying to find the authentic ground between them, in the same way as you're trying to find the ground between the different versions of bad faith. And that is its own seduction. So I've written about this. I feel quite strongly about this. Not that hypocrisy is a good thing, because it's not. And not that it's just a necessary evil, because actually I don't also think that it's necessarily an evil, but it is a fact. You know, it is part of the facticity of the world that we live in a world of hypocrisy. And you can be seduced by the frustration of that and the temptations of emancipation from it, which draw you towards things that aren't hypocritical because they are a lie. Because a lie isn't a hypocrisy. A lie is an untruth. You can tell an untruth without being a hypocrite. A hypocrite is almost by definition to have a double standard, part of which is closer to the truth than the other part that you're doing. The big lie is very tempting in a world of bad faith and hypocrisy. And so my example of that is Stalinism and Maoism, but I do accept that there are the liberal versions of it, the libertarian versions of it, which are a lie. Libertarianism, actually, at its most dogmatic, is a lie too. But these temptations are real for people who've kind of had their moment of, you know, existentialist, I've had enough of this, or they've moved from I can't to I won't, and they think, oh, I won't, so now I will, and off we go. I'm not saying it's all one way, but I'm saying it's a real temptation, and we should be wary of it.
Yeah, but I
Well, my personal case.
Yeah, it's a real temptation. But I think maybe that's where we also kind of part ways in a way. Because for me, although I acknowledge that that is an obstacle, it seems to me that in your case, it becomes that obstacle becomes paralyzing. And so then you end up saying, okay, well, in that case, I can't try anything because, you know, I can't. And I think I'm maybe a little bit more open to the possibility of actually you have to try and you just have to learn from what you failed in the past. And this is why I was saying I started with this idea of the importance of history and learning from history and conceptions of progress. That's exactly what progress is for me, that you actually try to develop a method of articulating what is it that went wrong in the past from trying to emerge with this authentic self from the circumstances, and what can you learn and how can it be done better. And so it's a trial and failure and it's a process of historical refinement, but you've got to always try, otherwise you're stuck, and you're stuck with a very, very bad present as well. I mean, there's nothing. So it seems to me that the flip side of what you're saying is that you end up then reifying the present and saying, well, not taking the risk is then fine because taking the risk would produce all these disastrous outcomes. And anyway, some people will take the risk anyway, so this is kind of also just speculative because the world doesn't work like that and history doesn't move like that. There's always someone who jumps, and we need to see, okay, what can we learn from that and how can we make the jump better next time? That's what I think.
So I don't think I'm saying that you shouldn't try, but I'm saying that what you shouldn't do is believe there is a way of trying which will rescue you from bad faith one way or the other way, or hypocrisy one way or the other way. You're going to have to live with that.
Right. So let me give you the kind of Kantian answer to that. There is a method that can be developed in the way of trying that does improve ways of trying. That's all I'm saying. So then we have to move from the critique of stuff to a kind of critique of method. And I think at that point it gets really hard. And this is where I also see some of the shortcomings of these existentialist philosophers, and indeed of a lot of kind of post-idealist philosophy more generally, is that they actually begin to question the method and they don't really have a better method to replace it with. So, yeah.
Okay. I'm now going to ask you, after we've been down that detour, to tell me why you think psychoanalysis is a better method.
Well, why do I think psychoanalysis has a better method? Because I think it is grounded on a critique of society as well as of the knowledge of the human psyche. So it seems to me that what Freud was offering, if we take Freud as the paradigmatic, you know, we talk about Freud as embodying some kind of psychoanalytic approach that was being developed around the same time as these existentialist approaches that we've been discussing. It seems to me that there's something in Freud that tries to explain what happens both at the level of the psyche, but also at the level of a collective psyche that is an account of society more generally as well. And I like, for example, to me, Freud's critique of religion is really important exactly in refining the kind of method through which we think about authority and how we relate to authority. And, you know, his all this discussion around the future of an illusion and why is religion an illusion, and trying to understand where religion comes from based on basic impulses of the human. All of that, I think, gives a kind of contribution to a scientific understanding of our development, both at the individual, but also at the collective level, which then in combination with other approaches from other sciences, you know, economics, history, sociology, philosophy, together is a bit more productive, maybe, than just insisting on this bad faith that seems to repeat itself and always repeats itself in the same form. So it seems to me that it just has a little bit more substance somehow.
But doesn't it also pose, if you think that the approach is the correct one, doesn't it pose a fundamental challenge to a rational understanding of how human beings experience the world and exist in the world? Because Freudian psychoanalysis also makes it very hard to believe in a rational self, because we are all made up of these different, not warring, but competing aspects of our own internal mental working, so that, you know, the three parts of it, the subconscious, the conscious, and the conscience, the thing that we're not aware of, the thing that is speaking, and when we shut our eyes and think, we think consciously, and then the overarching superego, the thing that is there and we have an understanding is there to regulate it. But none of those things is in charge. The conscience is not itself fully conscious. Consciousness is always at the mercy of the subconscious, but the subconscious can't take charge because the subconscious is subconscious. So it's, you know, by definition, even if it may be determining the outcome of your conscious thought, it's not itself the agent of consciousness. And there is no way of reconciling those things. You can't assert conscience. You can't assert the conscious. All you can do is spend years and years in analysis trying to understand the ways in which these things, often without you being aware of it, are shaping each other. Doesn't that, if it's true, make the things that you believe in harder, including rational self-consciousness?
Well, I guess I have a different interpretation of what psychoanalysis is about. To me, it is actually about self-understanding. And the starting position is that this is a dynamic entity. The human is dynamic. And so these things are not static. They change. What would be the point of psychoanalysis if we were to believe that none of this can ever change? What would be the point of trying to bring them to the surface and trying to change the balance between these different aspects of the, I call it the soul, because I like the fact that there is this overlap between the Platonic theory of the soul and the Freudian one, even though they're thousands of years apart. They're actually something about the way in which you think about the human mind, which is, you know, there's logos and there's this intermediate thing, and then there's the appetites or the instinctual part and something. I mean, Plato said something like that in the Republic, and I think, and in other works as well. But the basic point, as I understand it, is that this is a dynamic whole, and it's important to know the different elements and to think about the mastery and the relationship of these different elements. And that's what learning and knowledge offers. It's the capacity to relate these elements to each other in different ways, and possibly with greater emphasis on one rather than the other. The more we know about it, both at the individual level and at the collective level, the better we will be able to engage with ourselves as humans in our particularities and in our identities, but also as a species. So I think maybe I have a more, I don't know if it's a more optimistic account of what analysis is for or psychoanalysis is for. But I think, and you know, one of my criticisms of psychoanalysis is that it deals too much with the individual level. And I think what we need is really social psychoanalysis. One of the reasons why I actually don't have a therapist is that I always think I need Albanian level analysis. So if you come from a traumatic context or traumatic country, it's not enough to have individual psychoanalysis. You need people who are experts and trained in having psychoanalysis for collectives. And so if they can't provide that, then it's really hard to understand what's going on in someone's psyche, because they are also shaped by these greater social factors. But bracketing all of that, what I'm saying is that I think there is an account of psychoanalysis that says the point of it is also to, in a way like these other philosophies that we've just been discussing, to enable you to develop and to be a better person, a better human, and to have a better life, and to have more control over your emotional or instinctive, or however we want to define them, parts. And I think that's maybe a little bit different from how you described it, but I don't know if any analyst would actually agree with this, because I don't know. As I say, I've never met them, so on a one-on-one, so I don't know what they'll say about this.
I remember going to a talk many years ago by a psychoanalyst who'd written a book. It's called Stephen Gross, I think. And he'd written a book called The Examined Life, which is, you know, among other things, a pun on Socrates. You know, the unexamined life is not worth living. The examined life is, well, the examined life for him was being on the couch. He had spent 40 years having his clients examine their lives with him. And he said the central lesson that he took from this experience was that all human beings want to change so long as it doesn't mean changing, in the sense that you can indeed help them to understand in the way that you described the possibilities of change and the ways in which the different parts of the psyche relate to each other. And you can be trapped by reifying or essentializing those relationships and thinking, I can't, because this is who I am. But actually who you are is much more contingent than that, because it's a set of relationships between different parts of yourself. But that kind of change requires you to give up on the thing that you don't want to give up on, which is your sense of self. And it's really, really hard. And it completely spoke to me. I mean, I think it's true. I mean, I feel it's true of myself that change would be great if it didn't involve changing, because it's so hard to, and it sort of goes back to where we started, it's so hard to strike that balance between the things that you feel you are capable of emancipating yourself from and those things that you feel are an essential part of who you are. It's not that I'm saying it's impossible, but I do think it's really hard. It's demanding. And maybe you're right. You have to put the whole society on the couch. Actually, societies can change more easily than human beings can.
So then maybe this is actually where we're different, because I think maybe also because of my life and, you know, the different changes in my life, I think change happens anyway. It happens to all of us. It's going to happen. And there is a sense in which the world changes you. It's forced upon you. So it's not as though you can ever, you never have the luxury of not changing because you're always changing. The question is, are you going to be in control of this change? Either you're changing or people are changing the world for you. I mean, now, as we speak, people are making decisions about what's going to happen to us and that some of them might be catastrophic decisions. And they will affect how we think of who we are and our sense of self. And we may not be able to lie on a couch waiting for, you know, for years just to understand change because there'll be much more dramatic stuff happening around us. So what I'm saying is that because that change is being done anyway, some it happens all around us, we can either decide to be in control of it or we can decide that other people will be in control of it. But it's not that we can decide not to change because we are not in that position. Something is always changing outside us and around us. So this just go back, this may be what I've gathered from my life. And my life is always changing. Something is always changing. You know, the Berlin Wall falls and then I go to Italy and then I don't get a scholarship or I get a scholarship. And things are happening to me all the time that are not at all in a predictable path or in a predictable track. And so, you know, I have to just learn to master them somehow and to be an agent despite all of those changes around me.
But are the philosophies that you're drawn to, the ones that you've been describing here, Kantian, Hegelian philosophies, so let's take Hegel, who we haven't talked about, but the Hegelian philosophies that you're drawn to, this is going to sound too crude, but you are drawn to philosophies that put a whole social system, as it were, on the couch. That is that, you know, those different parts, those different elements that go together to make up the whole, so that we can understand what change is, so we can understand what it means for something to change. You want a philosophy that does it for the whole, in a sense, rather than a philosophy that is more focused on that happening at the individual level.
Yeah, because I don't think anything is happening at the individual level. Everything that the individual is the result of the social and of the social whole. And as we try to understand what's going on, we are always shaped by broader social forces. It's like the laws of nature. You know, we're always part of the laws of nature. And I think it's the same with society. We don't want to call them laws because I think they're more contingent and there is a degree of freedom, but there is a structure to them. And there is a structure to society. And that structure shapes who we are and how we think. And I don't think we can ever understand what the individual does or is without thinking about this larger whole.
Next time, it's the last episode in this series about the history of freedom. And for the final episode, I'm talking to Leia about liberation movements. Women's liberation, gay liberation, animal liberation. What comes next? Do also sign up for PPF Plus and you will get the bonus episodes that accompany this series. In them, Leia and I are going to be trying to answer some of your many questions that we've had. And also we're going to be talking about freedom in the age of AI and robotics. Do also follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas and on Instagram at PPF Ideas, and you can see some of the now many video clips that we've posted that go with this series. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.